50 years ago today, the House of Representatives passed the Civil Rights Act and handed it off to the Senate. This bill made it illegal to discriminate against someone based on race, religion, national origin, or gender.
At the time, this bill was met with a lot of opposition. In the Senate, for example, lawmakers blocked the bill for 54 days with a filibuster. In honor of the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, the Council on Contemporary Families asked researchers to take a look at how things have changed for the populations affected by this bill. We're talking about women, ethnic and racial minorities, and religious groups.
Here to break down some of the Council's findings on this topic is Stephanie Kuntz. She's a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also the director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
So 50 years after the House of Representatives passed the Civil Rights Act, does America look the way supporters of this bill hoped that it would look 50 years on down the road?
Oh, it's been a major change. Back in 1964, it was basically a white Protestant male-dominated country. The religious landscape, the racial landscape, and the relationships between men and women have just been revolutionized in the last 50 years. Take the religion. Back then, it was 70% of Americans were Protestants, most of them mainline Protestants. 25% were Catholic, but they were grandchildren of earlier white European, like Irish. There was almost nobody who didn't identify with one of the main religious traditions. Today, the number of mainline Protestants has been halved. Catholics are still 25% of the population, but mostly because of Latino immigrants. You have 20% of the population that doesn't identify with mainland, with any particular religious tradition. In 20 states, the largest non-Christian religion is Islam. In 13, it's Buddhism. So there's been a tremendous diversification of the religious landscape, a tremendous diversification of the racial landscape. Back then, 85% black, 11% white. Very few immigrants, well, in fact, the lowest number of immigrants in percentage of immigrants in American history, really. Today, 70% of the growth in the workforce in the United States is projected, by 2050, is projected to be Hispanics.
So it is a very different America.
Very different.
And do you put all of that progress that you just delineated down to the Civil Rights Act?
Well, no, not at all. These changes were occurring anyway, were going to occur. The big difference has been, I think, one of the good news since the Civil Rights Act, and I think the Civil Rights Act is not alone. There are lots of factors that created this, but the Civil Rights Act really did make it possible to mount real serious challenges to the kind of discrimination that used to be taken for granted. The gentlemen's agreements that said, and the quotas on Jewish admissions to universities, exclusions of Jews from country clubs, the prejudices, the outright segregation in the South, and the implicit accepted discrimination against blacks in the North, with riots against blacks if they attempted to move into white housing projects. Back in 1964, it was still legal to have help-wanted female, help-wanted male ads, to refuse to hire a woman for a job, to prefer, if she was working at the same job as a man, to favor the man on promotions, to exclude women, to put quotas on them for universities. All these things, the Civil Rights Act gave people a tool to work against. And the changes since then, both from the Act and from the kind of movements that helped actually get the Act passed, have led to a tremendous flowering of real tolerance in America. Now, we found that this tolerance, there's still active discrimination, and there's still also big legacies of discrimination. But really, the atmosphere, I think it's important to stop and celebrate just how big a change there has been. It's no longer respectable to say, as those filibusters did that you talked about, that they were going to fight to the bitter end against any social equality. Nobody would say that today. You can no longer say that women are stupid. Some people can say it, but it's no longer possible to say, I will not hire a woman because as a woman, she's not capable of doing this.
And yet, you found that there's still some work to be done. There's a lot to celebrate, as you just talked about, but are we to the point yet? Probably not, where, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, that you'd be judged by the content of your character rather than the color of your skin or your gender or your religion or some other thing.
No, there are some tremendous problems that we have, and there's two types of them. One is not necessarily outright discrimination, but the historic legacy of discrimination, that women for so long were channeled into occupations that were customarily paid less than men, not because they didn't require the same amount of training or the same amount of skill, but because women were in them. And it turns out that working class jobs are just as segregated today as they were, and as a result, women still earn much lower pay. And in fact, 62% of minimum wage workers are women. Women are much more likely to be poor than men. When we look at the situation of black Americans, yes, there's been tremendous progress for some. Nevertheless, the number of black Americans, 30% of black Americans born between 1985 and 2000, were born into areas where 30% of communities where 30% of the population was poor. When those kind of areas have rotten schools, they have terrible job prospects, they've got very few social support systems, there's much more crime, it's just a very much more difficult place to grow up and to get a good start. Only 1% of white Americans were born into such areas of concentrated poverty. And we also see, for example, that although there are many more black households that earn high wages today, the median wealth of white households is 14 times higher than that of blacks, again, because of the historic legacy. The schools they went to, the houses they bought were less, the inheritance they were able to pass on. But in addition to that, there are outright prejudices, and people, I think, underestimate just how strong those are. We've done controlled experiments where we look at hiring, and women are less likely to be hired than men. When they are hired, they're offered lower starting salaries. Same thing is true for blacks. There was one study that we looked at in a low-income community where whites were twice as likely to be offered a job or a callback even as equally qualified blacks. The only way that a black person had an almost equal chance to be hired as a white person is if the black person had no criminal record and the white person had just been released from prison. Mm.
Well, you talked about how there's a prejudice that exists and that we would be surprised at how much prejudice there is still, either evident to the eye or beneath the surface. And I wonder if this prejudice that you're describing is a prejudice that is sort of part of a historical legacy, or is this sort of new kindled prejudice that is coming up as we move through the times we're in now?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And I think that a lot of it is just the old associations. This goes back way, way. You know, they take these wonderful. Your listeners might want to Google implicit bias and look at these association tests. And it's kind of stunning to see how widespread our sort of biases are that we've inherited. But it takes people a lot longer to associate a female name with a description of somebody as competent or as a surgeon or whatever. And so this is a historical legacy. But I also think that there are people for whom that has been triggered and exacerbated by the very real progress that some blacks and some women have made, which is threatening to them. It triggers those biases. It brings them into the open and more virulently, especially, of course, with the with the sort of accelerator effect that the social media and the internet has made, that allows it people to be much more vicious in terms of expressing their prejudices.
We're talking right now to historian Stephanie Kuntz about the 50th anniversary of the House of Representatives passing the Civil Rights Act.
And we'd like to hear from you about this, too. Are you part of one of the populations affected by the Civil Rights Act? How do you think things have changed in the last half century, either for you or maybe for somebody you know? Do you think we are there yet? Have we reached the fulfillment of what the Civil Rights Act was designed to do? What still needs to be changed? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org.
We're picking up our conversation now with historian Stephanie Kuntz. She's the Director of Research for the Council on Contemporary Families, and she's talking about the Council's new report on how things have changed in the 50 years since the House of Representatives passed the Civil Rights Act.
And we are taking your calls right now. Let us know about your thoughts on the Civil Rights Act 50 years down the road. Do you think we're where we need to be? Have things really changed in the last half century in a way that you can see, that you can touch and feel? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Send an email, talk@wpr.org.
And Stephanie, we'll go right to the phone lines now. We've got Eric joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Hey, I'd just like to bring up a fact that something I've seen is my stepdad owned a business all through the 80s and 90s. He had a roofing business, and he'd go through a lot of people because a lot of people couldn't handle that kind of work. And he had black friends, and he was a deacon of the church, but he was scared to death to hire a black person to work for him because he was afraid if he had to fire him, like they did a lot of people, that they would say, oh, it's because I'm black, and have retribution against him.
Okay, thank you for your experience there that you shared, Eric. And how about how that did play out for people as they adjusted to the Civil Rights Act, Stephanie?
Well, I think that what we have is a much more complicated situation now, where because of the Civil Rights Act, sometimes it gives people a little leverage, a little maneuvering room. And I'm sure that there are incidents where a person who is incompetent and is fired claims that it's because they're black or because they're woman. On the other hand, we have seen so many very carefully controlled experiments where we actually send out equally qualified candidates, and if they are given black names or female names, they are discriminated against. So these are interesting trade-offs. But one that I found that very interesting, if you look at, for example, the way race and gender interact for black women, there are very many prejudices against black women. They did a fascinating experiment where they took the same face and they put different shades from white to black, and they put it in a game, as she was an avatar. The blacker the face, the fewer strangers interacted or were able, willing to do favors for that woman who looked exactly the same. On the other hand, one of the things that has been found in experiments that occasionally the prejudices against women are very clear. That if you're assertive, it's assertive in a man and it's bitchy in a woman. And yet, black women in careers sometimes find themselves given a little pass on that because the very stereotype of the angry black woman that works against black women so often, in many ways, actually is like, well, okay, the white woman is a bitch, but the black woman's just, your typical angry black woman, and it's not taken so much. So it's become more complicated since 1964, and there are more individual exceptions and contradictions. Nevertheless, racism and sexism still exist, and we need to really recognize that.
Can we talk for a bit about how progress is made? You talked earlier about how the big thing that the Civil Rights Act changed is that if you were discriminated against, if you faced prejudice, you had legal recourse for the first time. The Civil Rights Act is in place now. We've had legal recourse for a long time, people have who needed to use that mechanism. How do we make progress now?
Well, I think we have to remember that we still need such federal oversight and enforcement. One of the things we found when we were doing this summary of what had changed and what had not is that there have been real slippages in school segregation in the 80s and the 90s in districts where federal oversight was withdrawn. We found the same thing when the Supreme Court ruled that women could not could not sue for discrimination if after a certain amount of time had passed, until we got the Lilly Ledbetter Act back, there were real restrictions and some slippage for women in certain segregated occupations. So it's very important to recognize that we still need federal oversight, but that's not enough. We have to continue to work on our being able to work together. Studies of kids show that when you get people working together in a team, teaching each other and learning from each other, that that's one of the best things to decrease both racial and gender discrimination. So we have to work at many levels on this.
Let's go back to the phones now. Tom is joining us from South Beloit in Illinois. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, good afternoon. What I called in, what picked my ears was when you talked about the economic problems of women and minorities. And initially, the unions, the trade unions, wouldn't allow women and minorities in the unions. But once that changed, women and minorities were able to earn the same wages as other as men and other people. And where the backsliding is occurring now is with the demise of the unions, where women and minorities, as well as all the other working people, don't have the protection of the unions. And if you don't have economic power, you don't have any power at all.
Okay, thank you so much for your thoughts, Tom. Stephanie?
Well, I completely agree. I think that what we've seen in the last 30 years, despite progress for blacks and women, is that sometimes that progress has been made not as absolute progress, but just because the less educated, the former unionist white males have been sliding back. They've not been sliding back because of the progress of blacks and women. They've been sliding back because of the attacks on the living standards, the increasing inequality, and the tremendous decline of unionism in America. So that's another of the interesting complications. When in 1964, if you were a white male high school graduate, you automatically earned more than a black college graduate or a female college graduate. That's not true anymore. There's been a real slippage in the kind of privileges that were once given to white males. And one of the things that leads to some of the vitriol we were talking about earlier is that some of the men who have slipped behind blame their slippage on the progress of women and blacks instead of putting the blame where it belongs. And I agree with your caller that a lot of that blame, the fact that your average white male high school graduate earns $4 or less in constant dollars today than he did in 1970, that's not because of blacks and women. It's because of the increasing inequality and decline in real wages in America.
Well, let's talk about that. You said that these prejudices get especially virulent when they come into contact with growing income polarization. How so?
Well, because I think that when people are in trouble, they begin to look for ways that they can, if you're sliding down the ladder, you look for a place to hang on to and another rung to step on. And I think that one of the, I think that human nature can be very, very good. I'm not trying to say that it's all bad. But one of the unpleasant sides of human nature is that when we start to slip, sometimes it's tempting to try to gain our purchase by stepping on somebody else's shoulder. And I think that's the big challenge we have. As 80% of Americans, blacks, whites, men, and women, have been slipping further behind, have had their real wages stagnate or fall in the past 80 years, have experienced increases in economic insecurity, we have to make sure that we don't turn on other people and say, well, at least I should have an advantage over you because you're a woman or because you're a black. And that we have to make sure that we don't blame the slippage on the fact that blacks and women are saying we should all be equal. The whole point is that we should all be rising together equally, not that we should be pulling each other down or pushing somebody else down.
Stephanie, our last minute or so here, what is the most important thing that we need to be working on as a society to advance the intent of the Civil Rights Act?
Well, That's a big question and one that I hope that your listeners will think about for themselves. I don't have any easy answer, but I do think that we have to do what one of your callers suggested, which is understand that we have to look for racial and gender equity, to recognize that that's a potential strength and gives us potential allies, as at the same time as we look for more social and economic equity as well for people of all races and both genders.
Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Stephanie Kuntz, professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also the director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families. She was with us to talk about the council's new report on the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll check out some cool science news, including the up-and-coming world of sound tourism. Apparently, people travel to far-off places to hear unique sounds, things like sand dunes booming and singing.
But first, we're talking about a new bill in Wisconsin that would increase the training requirement for doctors. Republican Representative Eric Severson and Republican State Senator Leah Vukmir introduced the legislation last week. Both legislators have a medical background. Representative Severson is a doctor and Senator Vukmir is a nurse.
The bill would apply to graduates of American and foreign medical schools. And if the bill passes, graduates would need 2 years of medical training to get a license instead of just one.
Here to put this bill into context for us is Ed Miller. He's a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Can you tell us something about what prompted Representative Severson and Senator Vukmir to bring this bill to the floor of the state legislature?
I'm not exactly certain, because the very few physicians in Wisconsin have no training beyond 1 year. Typically, most of the doctors in today typically do a residency in some area. If they're primary care, they do it in family practice or internal medicine, typically, or pediatrics. But the so-called general practitioner who has 1 year of postgraduate training, which is the first year, which we used to call the internship year, and then goes into practice, are pretty small. And I'm looking at some of their data, it's well less than 1%. And my guess is that those individuals either are doing something else, administration, or they are older doctors who would be grandfathered in by this law.
So it sounds like you're saying after completing residency, which is typically 4 years, it seems as though most doctors would do something like a 2-year fellowship already.
Well, no, the residency would be 3 years after medical school for the shortest, and that would be like internal medicine or family practice. So that would be three. It's considered 3 years. The first, the so-called internship year, is now considered the first year of residency. But that particular year, then two more make the primary care, and it goes from about 3 to about 8, like for a neurosurgeon.
It was last year that Dr. Sheldon Wasserman, the former chair of the Wisconsin Medical Examining Board, told reporters that Wisconsin has become, this is a quote, a dumping ground for a lot of bad physicians who want to get their foot in the American medical system. What is your response for that?
I don't know what data he's looking at. I'm looking at the data from that they have on Wisconsin that was done essentially last year. And it shows less than 1%, depends how you count it. But if it says the number who have rotating internship or transitional year, that would be the 1 year only, it's 0.3% of Wisconsin physicians.
So what do you make of his claim that there are bad physicians in Wisconsin here who come here because it's, I guess, easier?
I have no clue. Because if you look at the data on other states, and I just looked at the data on other states. Virtually all the states only require 1 year. There's some that do require 2 years. Alaska requires 2 years. Most of the others require one year. Some require two. But for anybody to be hired by any major medical group, for example, and Wisconsin has a lot of them, between Marshfield and Aurora and Gunderson, they would all have to be at least, if not board certified, which would require minimally 3 years in things such as family practice, internal medicine, or be at least board eligible, which means they have completed the residency to be able to take the boards. And so they would have the same training, they just wouldn't have yet passed the boards.
Well, let's look more closely at the aspect that applies to foreign medical students. Are training requirements different for graduates from foreign medical schools?
Slightly. They are slightly different, and some states do have a little bit different. Usually, foreign medical graduates are required to have completed a residency rather than this 1 or 2 years have completed a residency in the United States. And so most states do require 3 years for foreign medical graduates, or I'm looking here, some require two, but most of them do require a full residency, and that would be normally 3 years. As I say, technically they could practice after a year, but normally nobody would hire them. They would have to have 3 years, and all the foreign doctors coming to the United States, you have to have a U.S. residency. So a number of the U.S. number of foreign doctors have actually done a residency back in their home country, and then come to the United States and having to do another residency to be able to be licensed.
Do you read in this any sort of concern or bias against foreign medical students?
Well, it could be. It could be, except they would not, as far as I'm aware, pick up many foreign medical graduates because they have to do a residency. So if you look at most of the foreign medical graduates that come in, whereas now it's called international medical graduates, they all had to do 3 years in the United States. And many of them have not been able to get a residency. For example, they may be ear, nose, and throat in, let's say, India, and have done a residency in India, ear, nose, and throat, and then come to the United States, and they can't get into the surgical residency, which is ear, nose, and throat. And so they become a primary care doctor, where Americans are less likely to be interested in it because primary care pays much less than other specialties. So they become for example, a family practitioner. And you may wonder, you look back and they were trained in ear, nose, and throat. The reason is they couldn't get into a U.S. residency in ear, nose, and throat if they wanted that. But they do in family practice.
Well, as you know, we've been hearing about a primary care shortage, especially in rural Wisconsin, and a projected nurse shortfall down the years. If this were to pass, do you see this affecting those numbers?
It probably wouldn't affect the numbers very much because most of the doctors all that I'm familiar with actually do have done a residency in the United States. Now, some may do maybe a 2 years because they've done a year, back in their home country, so they've given them sort of credit for a year. But they've done at least 2 years in the United States. And so if we go to 2 years, it's not going to make any difference. I don't know anybody's done less than that. Of the current ones. Now, in former times, that wasn't the case. In former times, many physicians, after they graduated medical school, did the 1 year, and they were then licensed. But that's not the case. Plus, the fact is medical school has changed. At one time, you went to 4 years of medical school, and the first time you really saw patients was the year of so-called internship. But today, the second 2 years of medical school are rotations. And you move around different specialties, and you do see patients at that time. So you do get clinical experience in medical school now, in addition to the postgraduate years. Actually, the move is in the other direction. The move is to shorten the amount of training time because we do have the doctor shortage. And they're talking about shortening the training time primarily in the area of medical school, going from 4 years of medical school to 3 years. That's a very debatable proposition, but that's what's currently being discussed.
Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
That was Ed Miller, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point.
The latest issue of Discover magazine doesn't hit newsstands until tomorrow, but we, and consequently you, are in luck today. One of the editors is here to give us a sneak peek at some of the coolest stories in this month's magazine.
Sound tours and bionic hands and exploring extreme landscapes in hopes of understanding what life is like on Mars. Gemma Tarlak is here to give us the details on these stories. She's a senior associate editor at Discover magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks.
So the first story you have for us is about sound tourism. This is something that's kind of new. What is sound tourism?
Well, it's really kind of the genius child of an acoustic engineer by the name of Trevor Cox from England, and he noticed in his own work, going around finding all these incredible sound effects, he started plotting them on a map and encouraging other people to send in sound files that he adds to the map. And some of the sounds are truly extraordinary. Booming sand dunes, for example. I think you've got the link on your site. It's kind of difficult to describe, but it's a synchronized avalanche of sand grains. So if you think about sliding down a sand dune, you can actually create music, and it's a very eerie sound. It sounds kind of like the world's largest didgeridoo or something.
And not only do we have a link on our Facebook page, but we also have an actual sound file here that we can play for you now. So let's listen to that. So there you go, those sand dunes making that didgeridoo-like sound. And that really is amazing and a good example of what Trevor is trying to accomplish, get people to actually take a moment. And in fact, that's what he recommends, that if people want to get started, just sort of cut out all the noise and take a moment and listen.
Yes, and you know, when you think about it, just going through our everyday, there are so many sounds that we completely ignore, whether it's the opening and shutting of a door or even the sound of the breath of the person next to you. And he said, you know, unplug your iPod, take off the earbuds, put down the smartphone, and just really listen and appreciate all the different sounds around us. And you'll find a lot of the ordinary sounds are actually quite extraordinary.
I want to go back to those sand dunes for a moment. In the video, which we've got a link to, there are people sort of scooting on their bottoms down this giant mound of sand. Really, that's what makes that noise?
Yeah, and I have to say, when I saw that video, all I could think about was how unpleasant it was growing up on the Jersey Shore and getting sand in my swimsuit. And I just thought, you know, it's a cool sound, but I'm not going to get sand in my pants to make it. I'm sorry. But, yeah, basically they are causing the avalanche. That's what creates the sound. It's the avalanche of sand grains. And apparently if you get enough people to do it and you're at the right dune and the sand grains are dry enough, it actually creates the sound. And one thing he said that I thought was really interesting, the pitch of the sound you hear depends on the size of the sand grains. So there are booming and singing sand dunes all over the world, places like Chile's Atacama Desert, and in California, Nevada, in China, Mongolia, and they all have different pitches or different songs, if you want to think of it that way, because of the different size grains of sand.
Wow, so that's pretty amazing. This is something that you could do on any sand dune, but you don't need specialized equipment to pick up a sound like that?
Well, actually, not all sand dunes do it. So I'm sorry if you had grand ideas of going out in the backyard with your sandbox. It's not going to work.
You read my mind.
Yeah, unfortunately, and they're not quite sure why some dunes do it, some don't. And when I was talking to Trevor, he mentioned that he and his team went out to the Mojave to record some booming sand dunes there. And they were so disappointed because they drove, from the airport all the way out into the desert, and they got nothing for the first couple days. And then finally on the last day, it was making the sound for them. So they still don't really understand why some dunes do it, some don't, the exact reason for why they'll do it one day but not another. But it's really a fascinating phenomenon.
So are people, when you propose the idea of sound tourism, how do people react to that? Because at first blush, it sounds a little abstract. You know, I'm going to go somewhere and I'm going to listen to what sort of thing?
Yeah, but again, that really gets back to what Trevor talks about in his book. Really, when you think about it, we are visual creatures generally, and there is just as much richness and depth in sound as there is in sight. So it's really not that different from saying, hey, you got to go to New Zealand to see the mountains, they're beautiful, than saying, hey, you got to go to New Zealand to hear the fur seals when they're mating, it's crazy. It's kind of the same thing, although we often don't think of sound as rich as sight.
Well, another top story that we're looking at and you write about and discover is this new prosthetic, a bionic hand. What is it about this hand that's new and different?
Yeah, well, this is something I covered online last week when the paper came out. And I have to say, for me personally, it was a great story to cover because so much of what I do is kind of less than good news. You know, sea levels are rising, influenza is mutating to be more deadly, et cetera. So it was great to be able to cover this really positive story. This European consortium of researchers got together and for the first time were able to implant tiny, tiny electrodes in the nerves of a patient's arm. And he had lost his hand in an accident about 10 years ago. They implanted the electrodes in his arm and hooked them up to a special prosthetic that had sensors that detected measurements and movements when the prosthetic's tendons changed. And when you think about it, if you run your hand over a book or over the shoulder of the person sitting next to you, your fingers move, sort of creating the contour that you're feeling. And this is how the tendons were measured by the sensors. Once the sensors detected the changes in the prosthetic's tendons, they had a software program that translated the change into an electrical signal that then traveled to the electrodes in his arm and conveyed the actual feeling. So, for example, this patient was able to distinguish between an orange and a baseball, which when you think about it is pretty incredible. He was able, though, to sense how the orange you could squeeze where the baseball was much firmer. And it's just a great story. Again, it's a case study of one patient. They've only tried it with one patient, and it's very early, but the results were so positive that they think this could be something very easy to develop in the future, and they could add additional sensors that could measure, say, temperature, so you could tell if you're touching something hot or cold.
And in the world of prosthetics devices, I mean, this is really, I think, amazing news and an amazing step. Any idea of the timeline? You said relatively soon. Is that 5 years, 10 years, 20 years?
Well, they didn't want to give one. Of course, that was the question everybody was asking. But just the results were so positive from this one trial. And I have to say that it was kind of sad because after a certain amount of time, they had to remove the electrodes from this poor guy's arm just because of clinical trial protocols. You know, they couldn't leave them in because the trial was completed. So he's without the prosthetic now, unfortunately. But hopefully within the decade, maybe even sooner, we're going to see just fantastic advances built on this.
What did it look like?
It is not the prettiest thing in the world. It's kind of this big, blocky, and I have to also say it's not wireless yet. So they're working on that, and they're working on refining and shrinking all the electronics involved. But it looked kind of like maybe a 1950s very basic robot hand. The lifelike prosthetic is not quite there in this one area.
Hmm. Moving on to the cover story this month in Discover, an astrobiologist is studying alien landscapes, but he's doing it right here where we live on Earth.
Yeah, astrobiologist Chris McKay works for NASA, and he has, I think, kind of a dream job. He travels all over the world to really remote places, the coldest place, the hottest place, the driest place. So he's in the deserts and in Antarctica and all over. And what he's looking for is to figure out, okay, there is life in Antarctica. How is that life existing? How did it evolve? If this life also exists on another planet or on a moon, how can we figure it out? What are the signatures of this life so that we can develop tests, say, for the Curiosity rover on Mars, to see if this kind of life also exists outside our planet? And really fascinating work. And again, he travels to some of the most amazing locations on our planet.
What are some of those locations? Where has he been?
Well, Antarctica and the Arctic and Iceland and, of course, California's Mojave Desert. That keeps coming up in this issue. But also our cover, if you look, it's a really extraordinary photo of this Tanzanian volcano called, and I'm probably going to mangle it, but Oldonyolungai. And this volcano is unique on our planet. It is the only carbonatite lava volcano, and most volcanoes are basalt, but this is the only one on Earth that has this super runny kind of lava. It has a different mineral composition than other types of lava. And they look at this lava at this Tanzanian volcano, and they think that that same kind of lava might be on Venus, because Venus has thousands of miles of lava channels, and they can't really figure out how these lava channels were created. Most lava doesn't travel that far. But this one Tanzanian volcano, they think, has the right super runny, it's kind of gross actually, super runny lava that might explain the volcanoes and the lava channels on Venus. And, you know, who would ever think to look in Tanzania to understand Venus better?
So once he's got the data in hand, and let's use this lava as an example, how do you go about sort of proving that maybe, or trying to prove that it may have some relationship to lava on Venus?
Well, they do a lot of different things. They do a lot of different measurements, and, you know, they're refining all the time the instrumentation to get data from Venus and from, you know, he also studies, for example, one of Saturn's moons, Titan. So they're getting all this refined data, and they're able to compare it to things on Earth and try to figure out, do we see similarities? Do we see the same signatures? It's, you know, it's still definitely a work in progress, but just their understanding has increased.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Gemma, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha.